The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
All right, welcome back. The time now is 9:30 and we're joined by one of my favourite writers, as it happens, international best-selling author, voracious reader, and a man trying to avoid an honest day's work at the office, John Connolly. Good morning, John.
That makes two of us there, thank you. You've made a career out of it, though.
You think this is a work? John, it's always great to see you. Thanks for coming in this morning. Are you a Christmas man? Do you like it or do you avoid it? Or
no, I am a Christmas man. We've kind of slightly melancholy this year. Last year, my son is moving over to South Africa to live with his girlfriend. So it'll be the last time that all of us will be together this way. So it's quite the end of an era thing.
But I
love Christmas. I think it's a lovely, lovely time of year.
You embrace it, Andy.
Yeah, although they did have that one day last year where you think, I've had enough. Yeah. You're queuing in the post office, you know, the person in front of you is counting out pennies and you're thinking, oh, for God's sake, there's only so much spirit a man can have, you know.
We asked you to come in to talk about, did you have a good year's reading as a matter of interest?
I think I had a better year reading non-fiction than fiction this
non-fiction.
Year. I'm not sure this was a great year for fiction for me, but one of the other things is that there's so much new stuff comes out and I've reached that age where I'm conscious of all these gaps in my knowledge. So very consciously now each year I'm going back and I'm reading classics that I really should have read a while ago and books that I thought, well, maybe they're going to be too difficult. And I don't want to be on my deathbed thinking, well, I read X when I should really have read Dickens at some point. Yeah. So I've been trying to break it up in that way. So a lot of the fiction I read this year was slightly older stuff.
It's a strange thing with reading, I've noticed, but as you get older, you can handle a book better. And with life experience, certain books and stories just make sense in a way that they couldn't have possibly before.
Yeah, you can read the right book. You have the right book in your hands at the wrong time.
Right, exactly.
And I remember trying to read Bleak House when I was younger. And Bleak House is just not a book you can read when you're young. But, you know, when you get into your 30s, you begin to understand a little bit more what's going on about. So you're right, you absolutely bring life experience. And what I've always said to people is, you know, books are not fixed objects. Everybody will read a book in a different way because you do bring your life experience to it. And that transforms everything that you read.
Which brings me to, I suppose, my first recommendation in some ways, because with the toy show and with everything going on in the world, I find I've an adult brain because I'm trying to think about 10 different things to be doing and I'm thinking of lines and things to be playing with and fun to be at and so on. So I need a book that's going to bring me somewhere completely different. And it was actually sent to me as part of a book club thing, the Dubray thing. I get a book a month and sometimes I hand the book back and say, that's not for me. And this one I was about to hand back and the listener said, no, read it. It's called Disillusion by C.J. Sansom. It's about a hunchback a lawyer in 16th century England. I thought, this is the most boring sounding book I'm ever going to read. But it's a series. It's Matthew Shardlake and the Disillusion is of the monasteries and he goes around solving crimes and it's Henry VIII and it's Cromwell and so on. And I'm hooked. It brought me to that gorgeous world and he paints it so well and there's six of them. So if you've got a history lover in your life or your family, who can handle this idea of the book and then just likes Inspector Morse.
And it's a
very
big chunk
gentle.
Of change, that book, isn't it? You could make it makes a handy step or a table.
Yeah,
it doubles as a whole lot of things.
It does.
It's about
it does.
700 pages, I think.
Well, it's close to about six or thereabouts, but that would be prohibitive to me. I'd find that a bit too much, a bit daunting. And in fact, I tried to find bigger print, what do you call those retail?
Braille books.
Well, not quite Braille. I can make it through the print, but they have the other, the airport bus size copies of it.
Oh, you are getting old.
Yeah,
I am.
No,
dear,
there's no
dear.
Doubt about it. And I also, but with this one as well, he kept introducing me to new words in a way that I haven't had for a while. So I dug up my sister's old dictionary.
Yeah.
And I'm checking words out like a student. Anyway, that's my first. What's your first?
I might start with one of the best books. Can I pick something slightly older?
Think this is a free fall. It's just a coffee shop chat.
I picked up a book called Child of All Nations by a writer named Imgard Kuhn, K-E-U-N. I'd never heard of it. It was reissued as a Penguin Modern Classic quite recently. And I thought, this is going to be the most depressing book. It's only about 120 pages long. It's about a child moving through Europe just before the outbreak of the Second World War. And I picked it up and it was the most delightful book. If you're looking for a book for the person who's a reader but you're convinced has read everything, I guarantee you won't have picked up this little book. And it's extraordinary. Imgard Kuhn, she was a really interesting woman. She was exiled by the Nazis just before the Second World War because they didn't like what she was writing. She was an alcoholic. She was seeing a Jewish doctor. She ended up living in Amsterdam for a little while, was seeing the writer Joseph Roth. And then the Telegraph in England accidentally reported that she committed suicide when she hadn't. And so she sneaked back into Germany and lived under a pseudonym because everyone assumed she was dead. But she led a kind of very bad life. You know, she really had a tough old life. She was an alcoholic all her life. She ended up homeless. She ended up in an asylum. And then at the end of the 1970s, her work was discovered, all these wonderful books she'd written in the 1930s. And what's beautiful about Child of All Nations is that it is her experience in that she was that woman moving around Europe. The Nazis had made her a non-person, so she didn't have a passport. So she wasn't a citizen of anywhere, so no one would take her. But instead of writing it from her own perspective, she creates this figure of a child, this 9-year-old child called Cully, who's incredibly precocious and incredibly witty and self-aware. And it's through Cully's eyes that we see everything. And that's why the book, it doesn't become a tragedy at any point, because you're always looking at it through the eyes of this optimistic child who's convinced that everything is going to be better. It is such a wonderful book.
Oh, I love it.
A really delightful book. And that was certainly, because it was so unexpected, a bit like you reading the Chardelet book, the C.J. Sansa. You've got something, you think, oh, this is going to be a chore, and you read it and think, I'm so glad I read the book. And I have no idea how I picked it up. But yeah, if you go into a decent bookstore or one with a kind of eclectic taste, or God, even if you go to a bookstore now, they can order it in time for Christmas. It's only about 120 pages long, but absolutely delightful.
Child
book.
Of All Nations by Irmgard Kuhn. Okay, that's now top of my list to read, which is tremendous, and thank you for that. I'm going to go for one that I unfortunately had to find online because it was out of print. So that makes this one a little tricky. But because you are you and you've written one of my favourite books of the last 10 years, that being He by John Connolly, about the life of Stan Laurel, looking back over his career and life and times. It was a book that got right under my skin, and I've given it to many, many famous guests on The Late Late Show to say, you'll enjoy this.
Thank
because,
you very
no,
much
I really mean that. You know, I've said that to behind your back and I'll say it to your face, and it's one that people need to read if you haven't already. So that brings me to the other suggestion, which is I, Fatty by Jerry Stahl, S-T-A-H-L, about, and because I'd read yours, I said, who was Fatty Arbuckle? I was just curious to know this guy. And it's written as if Fatty Arbuckle is telling the story. So it's written in almost 1920s, 30s zinger. Mm-hmm. Every line's a zinger. A screwball
so
almost.
It's a novel?
It's a novel.
Okay.
But not dissimilar to the style that you wrote in. Yours is more reflective. This is probably a bit more, quick paced. But it gets into his life, which was a complete tragedy, but also reflective of the time in America where, you know, the Hollywood became the bad guys.
Yeah.
And the people, the puritanical sense of you can't be doing that, you can't. So I just thought that was another humdinger of a read, which I think you'd really enjoy.
Yeah, I've read something quite slightly more recent. I read Wild and Crazy Guys, was one of my film books of the year, by Nick DeSemley. And Wild and Crazy Guys is about the generation of comedians that came out of Saturday Night Live in the 1970s. So it's Don John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd.
And particularly
Bill Murray. And my favourite anecdote of the year this book. So Bill Murray, who I think is just wonderful, but I would never want to work with or be stuck in an elevator with for very long.
Yeah.
So he's making Groundhog Day, which is, you know, just a fantastic movie. But he's stopped communicating with the director. He and Harold Ramis have fallen out entirely. So there's no communication at all between them. And you can't direct a star who won't talk to
you. Yeah.
So they organise basically a crisis meeting. And so they're sitting down and it's suggested that what they need is go-between. That somebody who, the director will tell this person, who will then go to Bill Murray, and Bill Murray will go back and give his response to the director. And Bill Murray nods and says, well, he says, that seems like a very sensible idea. And he says, and because I'm the star, obviously, I'll hire and pay for the person. So he hires a deaf woman. And at that point, you think, that's about as passive aggressive as a human being can possibly get. But I thought, that was just quite brilliant. That's checkmate.
Isn't it really?
You knock the board over and go home, which I just thought was wonderful. The book itself is very, very interesting.
Is it full of anecdotes like that?
Oh, it is. It's just anecdote after anecdote. And the making of films, and a lot of us would be quite familiar with, I think, from our generation.
I love it. That's called Wild and Crazy Guys by Nick DeSemlian. So again, that'll be all on the Facebook. Going a bit more novelly, if I may, Where the Crawdads Sing, which was very popular.
No, I've seen that record. I don't know anything about that.
Well,
book,
I saw it. I didn't like the cover.
Okay.
That's how deep down superficially I am.
Oh, but that's no. That's never judge a book by the cover. Is true of everything but books. You know.
Thank you. John.
It really is. It's the first thing you see in a book.
I
so you think I like the cover. It's a really important thing. So I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you were being hard on yourself.
Okay, I was
there.
Thank you for saying that. I feel better about myself. Delia Owens, Where the Crawdads, and I just thought, I'm not sure about that. And the guy in the bookshop said to me, actually, it's really good. And I tried it and I put it down, and then I came back to it. The way your mind plays tricks on you sometimes, and said, actually, I really like this. And what it is, it kind of It's about nature. It's the, it's kind of the South in some ways. I think it's Florida, actually. And it reminds me of that To Kill a Mockingbird style of storytelling. And I don't know why, but it's just a very beautiful, kind read. There's not much more to say about it because it's kind of impossible to explain other than to say it's just a good, for the person in your life who likes a good read, but not too long a read.
And the narrator is an adult narrator?
Yeah, she's a child who grows as an adult, living in the swamps, essentially, like a swamp child, but has a natural inclination towards beauty, nature, and is funny enough, an uneducated intellectual.
Yeah.
You know, some people are just born that way and can't help themselves. A beautiful book. And I'll just couple that with two others on the go, because I've mentioned them a few times here, so I don't need to get into them. Fleischman is in Trouble.
Oh, see, I hated that book.
Ah, interesting. Oh, we now have a row on our hands.
I got really annoyed by that book.
Go on.
Okay.
Midlife man having a midlife crisis.
I feel I should take my jacket off.
No, go on.
You know, I
oh, no, the water's out now, lads.
Yeah, there is a little bit of that. I found it very difficult to connect with any character in that book. And increasingly, one of the reasons why I think young men, it's hard to get young men to read fiction sometimes. And quite often in this Me Too era, there are the representations of men in fiction, particularly in literary fiction, tend to be quite negative for quite good reasons. And, you know, the Taffy Brodicker, it's all I can remember.
Brodicer Ackner.
Yeah, Brodicer Ackner. You know, I think is a relatively young woman and is, I think, is writing out a little bit out of this Me Too period. And I found that just its reputations of men were just so depressing. There was not really a single male character that I thought at any point could I put a finger on and say, look, actually, that's a standard to aspire to, or that represents really men in all their complexities. And I think sometimes one of the reasons why young men pick up fantasy literature or science fiction, and to some degree crime fiction does it as well, is that it gives you representations of male behaviour that are actually kind of admirable, that are heroic. That, you know, in a crime novel you'll find male detectives acting not because they're being paid to act or because it's an obligation to them, it's a career obligation, but out of a sense of moral obligation.
It sounds to me like you're describing a Donald Trump voter.
I guess
feels dispossessed by the Me Too movement, who are writing misrepresenting men.
I just found the Fleischman is in Trouble so relentless, and I didn't buy the final twist, not giving anything away. There is a kind of twist that comes at the end where we realise that we have misjudged one of these characters, and the book may not be about the person that we think it's about. But none of that rang true at me. I just wasn't prepared to go along with that central thesis.
That's why I love books, because I was recommending The Hunting Party by Lucy Foley, which I thought was great fun Agatha Christie pastiche, and I still stand by that. But a few people have said to me since, you know, how did you recommend that book? I said with ease, because I thoroughly enjoyed it. But the other one I was going to mention, I don't know if you read Three Women by Lisa Tadeo, which is non-fiction.
No, I haven't. No.
And the reason I mentioned that is because this book is very—it's raunchy.
Yeah.
And that's one way of putting it. But it's also of its time as well, because it deals with difficult subjects in relation to sex and abusive scenarios as well. And that's why I say the word raunchy. There are elements of it which are, and then there's are much more serious and not to be considered in any way flippantly. But I found, again, as a man, I got a kind of great insight into, much like watching Fleabag, we talked to Phoebe Waller-Bridge here recently, getting an insight into the psyche of the modern woman by reading this book, I thought. Now, women who've read the book might come back and say, please don't judge us on that. But equally, you could say, don't judge men on Fleischman.
Yeah, so, I think that was it. Yeah, I found that maybe it was being immersed for 500 pages in that much toxic masculinity at times. But so can I pick? I'm going to pick something I really like, and then I might have another rant if that's okay. But the history, the book that I love this year is called A Woman of No Importance, The Untold Story of the American Spy Who Helped Win World War II by Sonia Purnell. And this is a book, if I had written this as fiction, it would be rejected. And somebody would say, nobody is going to believe this, because it's about Virginia Hall. She was an American who managed to shoot her own leg off in an accident with a gun when she was out hunting. And so she was at a desk job with the Americans, and she wanted to help in the Second World War, and they wouldn't give her anything to do because they thought, you're just a woman. And she got the SOE in England to agree to send her into occupied France. And she set up the resistance networks in occupied France. And the book's astonishing. It is one of the tensest reads, because the Gestapo. They know she. They know that the network is being run by a limping woman. And so they begin closing on her and they begin picking off everybody around her. And at one point her cover is blown and she goes, she walks across the Pyrenees, the snowbound pass in the Pyrenees, and hides the fact that she has one leg from the guys who are guiding her.
How?
Because if they find out, they'll either kill her or they'll abandon her because they'll view her as a you know, as potentially bringing the Nazis down on them because she'll be moving too slowly.
Yeah.
And then she goes back. Even though her cover's gone, she goes back and she sets up the network for D-Day. And at the end of the war, her all her efforts are not recognized because de Gaulle in particular wants to peddle a story of this being entirely a French effort, that the Americans, the British were not involved. She doesn't get the credit. She's not given any work during the Cold War. And I knew nothing at all about this woman's
Amazing.
Story. And when I read it, I just thought this was fantastic.
Can't wait to read. All the books you recommended are going out.
Yeah. But then one of the two things made me annoyed. We can go on to stinkers in a minute. But
yes.
The quote that made me annoyed this year, more than anything else, and maybe I'm getting to that age where I get annoyed about stuff, was Colin Tubby.
I knew you were going to mention Colin Tubby.
I don't do any genre fiction books, but really, none of them. It's blank, it's nothing, it's like watching TV. Now, a couple of things here. Firstly, he doesn't own a television, so he's comparing something he doesn't read with something he doesn't own.
But he's probably watching stuff on laptops. When people say, I don't own a TV,
I'm vaguely aware that John Logie Baird invented something that's a box in a corner, I'm sure.
Go on.
What I couldn't get over, A, was the kind of weird anger underpinning it. It was like, you know, coming across your granddad on the lawn in his pyjamas shouting at clouds. And you want to say, just come in and sit down, have a cup of tea and a biscuit and it will all be well. There are three things here. Look, firstly, you can have your opinion about stuff. I don't read, I'm not big on legal thrillers. If it's legal, it's not thrilling as far as I'm concerned. But I understand that
people like them.
And that's just a very personal taste. But that's one very small subsection of genre fiction. It's very hard to read. Genre is embedded in the DNA of all fiction. It's very hard to think of great American novels, for example, that don't have a crime in them. You know, it's a tool and it's how it's used. The second thing is it's very hard to talk about Irish literature, particularly Irish literature up to the start of the 20th century without mentioning genre, because so much of it is Gothic or fantasy or horror. And the third thing is Colin Tobin wrote an introduction to Dracula. Now, the last time I looked at Dracula, that had a vampire in it. Now, maybe they took the vampire out in the interim and it's just about a man from Romania on his holidays, but I don't think so. So is it only a genre fiction if it doesn't have a penguin on the spine? So I just found this absurd. What I did when I wish Colin Tobin was here so I could just moderate this debate.
Oh my goodness.
One of the things I did was I got so annoyed about this and I thought, actually it's so dismissive and it's so old man angry, that I interviewed a writer named Becky Chambers. And I think Becky Chambers is an absolutely stunning young novelist. She is a gay American writer. She's writing in science fiction, traditionally a very male sexist preserve, and she writes these books about tolerance and inclusivity and gender.
She's
and
on your
sexuality.
List.
Yeah. She wrote a lovely a novella called To Be Taught If Fortunate, which I loved during the year. It's about a crowdfunded, essentially, exploration of four planets. And it has a death in it. It's the death of a non-human creature. And the death of this creature has stayed with me more than anything I've read in crime fiction all year. It's the most astonishingly moving sequence. But if you have a teenager in the house, especially if it's a teenager who's dealing with issues of sexuality or gender, to go and read Becky Chambers, particularly the first novel, The Long Way to a Small Angry Planet. And I just think, Colm, there's many things that one can admire about Colm, and I am having a go at him, to be fair. But you know, to dismiss this young woman who's using genre in a very, very serious way and using it to deal with real life issues, but without being preachy, to find a way to approach them and to make them palatable for a wider audience. And when you say things like that, you risk dismissing a whole lot of people who are doing things very seriously and who are working to the highest standards within the genre. So I got kind of annoyed about that.
Okay.
And that's why I want to mention Becky Chambers. And alongside it, Sarah Davis Goff from Tramp Press.
I love that.
To see an Irish writer writing horror fiction. Because we do it for younger adults and for kids, but people like her and Swan River Press, the lovely press in Dublin that's reissuing older male Irish writers male writers in the fantasy and horror genres, and particularly female writers, a lot of neglected writers. We have this great tradition that we shouldn't ignore.
I agree. The last ones left alive, which had that zombie, almost post.
Yeah, and that's another thing. I don't like zombie fiction, but she sold me on it. I thought it was a fantastic book.
We need to take a breather. I will say one thing in defense of Colin Tobin. I think The Testament to Mary is one of my favorite Irish books that he did.
He's not completely evil. Don't get me wrong.
we'll take a breath. We'll be back. John Connolly live in studio. We're talking about books of the year and other stories.
The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1.
Yeah, John Connolly with us live in studio. Text where Sarah in Glenmire and Cork says, good read. You liked the Crawdads good and you loved the Shard Lake series and read them all. I will. Okay, I hated Fleischmann is in trouble as well. I fully agree with John, says Deirdre in Dingle. That's great. You are united in your in distaste. Please wish John all the best to him and his. I'm an avid fan. This is from Carmel Ryan. I want to thank him for hours of contented and sometimes haunted reading. Bring on the next one. Yeah, and it's true. Try the two non-medieval books by Sansom, Dominion and A Winter in Madrid are both brilliant. Finish the full Charlie Parker series. That's John's series there. Only last week, says Aidan, feeling bereft. A big thank you to John for his brilliance and a happy Christmas thank to the you. Two of you. Very nice to hear that too. And of course, you'd fully expect it. Gemma is... on to say my book of the year was Shadow Play. I read it in sunny Portugal and was transported to rainy London. That's Joseph O'Connor's book, which I think was probably near the top of my list this year for book of the year. Absolutely loved what he did reimagining Bram Stoker traipsing through the theatre of London, the Lyceum in London. A gorgeous book. I also came late to the party to John Boyne's The Heart's Invisible Furies, which I gobbled up, and that comes with a hearty recommendation. And John, give us a. Can I ask you? Actually, we'll ask you about one. Jane Harper, The Lost Man. I read that too. How did you feel about that?
I'd loved The Dry, like a lot of people, which was Jane Harper's first book, and had this fantastic sense of pace. And then I thought she had difficult second novel syndrome with Force of Nature, which I wasn't as keen on. But I think The Lost Man is a really wonderful book, and it is that rare thing. One of the reasons why maybe I struggle with writers like James Patterson is that they tend to throw in a body every couple of pages to keep the pace going. And Jane Harper makes this gripping mystery out of a single death that occurs at the opening that may actually even be semi-accidental.
Yes.
But it's that sense of place she evokes, that sense of the outback, the heat, the desolation, these small communities. And it's really important because landscape plays such a huge part in mystery fiction. And if you get that wrong, the book simply doesn't work.
Yes.
And so it was one of my favourite genre novels of the year, along with a book called Joe Country by Mick Herron. And Mick Herron, I think, is kind of the humorous heir to John le Carré. Okay. He's written this fantastic series. You're looking for something for Dad. About they're the spies that the British have kind of put out to pasture because they've been incompetent or they've done something wrong, and they end up in this horrible building called Slough House, being run by a guy called Jackson Lamb, who's just a dreadful human being but a great spy, and so he's done this amazing sequence, and it is John le Carré with a sense of absurdist humour, and really, yeah, really, really gripping, and he's just getting better and better and better, Mick Herron, and so yeah, one of my joys has been discovering this Slough House. They're called the Slough House series. But you go back to the first, which is Slow Horses. But you can pick up at any point in them. And I just think they're really, really gripping espionage novels. And I'm a sucker for an espionage novel.
All right, I know. And I'm going to go for a nonfiction next, which was one of my favourites of the year again. This is The Patient Assassin by Anita Anand, which brings together a moment in the Indian history and wraps it up with a story that involves Tipperary and an Irishman who gets near to the top of the Raj. But she writes it at breakneck speed. And it's a cat and mouse game. But because of the Irish and the Indian factor, I was completely hypnotised by it. I was enthralled by it, and I was led to a part of history.
The patient assassin.
The patient assassin. I won't get into the detail now because it goes on too long and I get too excited. But it's just a beautiful thriller of a non-fiction read. So that was one. And again, it's non-fiction, but I read a lot of Trump books this year. But I think the best of them was probably just for insight and fun. They're really easy books to read. Jim Acosta is the CNN correspondent. We had him on the show here with his book, The Enemy of the People. So if you want to do one Trump book, that's where I'm going to go on that one.
Okay, I'm going to pick a non-fiction book.
Good.
Okay, Dean Martin, Everybody Loves Somebody. Sinatra, Strangers in the Night, Mrs. Robinson by Simon and
Garfunkel. Great songs, one of
California all. Dreaming by the Mamas and the Papas. I'm a Believer by the Monkees. Viva Las Vegas by Presley. You've Lost the Love and Fiction, Feeling by the Righteous Brothers. All Glen Campbell. Every time you listen to them, Glen Campbell is playing guitar somewhere on those songs. And so a book that I didn't think, I thought this is going to be stretching an idea out, it's called The Wichita Lineman, Searching in the Sun for the World's Greatest Unfinished Song by Dylan Jones. And it's a book about Wichita Lineman, which I didn't realise is an unfinished song.
Neither
that was the
I.
first thing I learned.
Lovely
in
song.
Fact, Jimmy Webb had been struggling. I could not like somebody who doesn't like Wichita Lineman. At that point, you're not my friend. You're not coming to my wedding. It's like people who don't like P.G. Woodhouse, just stop talking to me now. You know, you could be saving orphans and I still don't care. But yeah, so what happened was Jimmy Webb was struggling with this song. Glenn Campbell would say, have you finished it yet? And Jimmy Garr said, listen, I'll send you what I have listen to it and I'll come back to you. Of course, they listen to it and think, this is fantastic. We're recording this before somebody else does. And so they send Jimmy Webb back the finished version of the song. And Jimmy Webb goes, but it's not finished. I'm still working on the third verse. And they go, it's finished now. And I just thought, particularly about Glenn Campbell. Glenn Campbell in 1963 alone played on 586 sessions.
Wow.
He was this extraordinary man. He'd never learned to read music. But if you played him a piece of music, he would know it automatically when he went to it again.
Amazing.
And often they would, when a composer, when songwriters were producing a song, they would leave a section just saying Glenn solo. And he would make it up on the spot and that would go into the finished version. And it's a lovely book, not just about the creation of this song, but about Campbell himself. And I remember going to see him in 2012 when he was on his final tours because he was suffering from Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And he told the same joke about True Grit three times in a row because he couldn't remember having said. But when he went back, to Galveston or to Wichita Lyman, he had this memory came straight back in. And it's a fascinating book just about place in America, these wide open spaces and how they create, they affect the cultural imagination.
Another classic and a great documentary, I'll Be Me, about Glenn Campbell's last days, well worth looking at. The Nickel Boys by Colson Whitehead goes with
that's on my Christmas list for over Christmas.
Yeah. Great. And again, a beautiful book to gift someone because it's only about 150-200 pages, so they can actually read it and not have to pretend they liked it or didn't read it. Yeah. If you give somebody a book beyond 200 pages, the pressure's on.
So speaking of that, I mean, we've been very nice about books, generally speaking.
Oh, are we ending on a
stink? Come on, you're stinkers of the year, because there must be somebody just saying we want to put a big warning sign, you know?
Yeah. Do you know what? It was so bad. The neighbours next upstairs, the family upstairs.
Okay.
I didn't mention it when I said how much I disliked it. It just was. You know when you see an actor acting?
Yeah.
I could see the writer writing. Desperate.
I read two, the slightly less stinky of the two, The Order of the Day by Eric Vuillard, which won all of these prizes, a piece of metafiction about the events leading up to Second World War. It's glib, it's patronising, it's unfunny. And if you'd taken the cover off it and scribbled out the author's name and handed it to somebody, they'd finish it and go, I bet a French bloke wrote this. You know, because it was so annoying.
One? We have to go.
But the ripest piece of camembert in the shop, the stinkiest piece of
go
cheese,
on.
Carrie Mora by Thomas Harris, the kind of book
I couldn't read it.
It's the kind of book you'd write if they took your pet hostage and gave you 48 hours to write something to cover the ransom. Carrie Mora, leave it alone.
John Connolly, you're the most scintillating company. I've got a list of books now for the next year. Thank you so much. When can we expect another piece of work from you?
Oh, thank you. April. It's called The Dirty South.
Cannot wait already. John Connolly, thank you. Happy Christmas to you.
Many
yours.
Happy returns to you, Ryan. Thank you very much.
I'm exhausted, lads.